lines and circles. Psychologists from the Climate Psychology Alliance, along with activists from groups like Greenpeace, have been suggesting that all humans need to feel the enormity of climate change, but resist defeatism. For many people, the acceleration of climate crisis has led to feelings of paralysis, when we actually need to venture into this reality with our hearts open to survival. Once we make the cognitive and emotional leaps of imagination that enable radical hope, it's more likely that we'll embrace both individual and collective action and be less likely to sit back and let the impacts of climate change be felt unevenly. There's a romanticism within this resistance to defeat. In art and literature, romanticism is visible in the imagery of adventure and brave-hearted, individualistic behaviour that invokes a heroic past. We can't ignore that this heroic past is tied to the frontiers of colonisation, and this behaviour doesn't necessarily lend itself to rational collective action. However, the 19th century romantic attitude also influenced the intersubjective visions and emancipatory politics of Dada and Surrealist artists, who complicated the narrative of the individual and offered open-hearted leaps of imagination. The historical resonance of that moment reminds us how art has the capacity to envision alternative realities, allowing us to imagine ways of living and loving beyond what feels rationally possible in the present. In doing so, art contributes to the project of building new political imaginaries. In politics, the allegory of the line has been used to illustrate how white working class voters in the United States have internalized the image of a line in which they are waiting for their turn to receive a fair share of public resources and the financial and social advantages of capitalism, jobs, housing, health services, etc. The people in the line aren't necessarily expecting huge material gains, but simple middle-class wealth and basic social services. Despite ongoing claims to American exceptionalism, this progression and access hasn't ever been available to everyone, and it has become even harder to access over the past 50 years. The line comes into play in emergency situations too, and has become important over the past decade as extreme weather events and the need for disaster relief has increased. When one sense of access to resources is imagined as linear, it becomes easy to perceive anyone else entering that line as decreasing your own access. At the same time, it becomes easy to perceive other concerns or shared challenges as distractions and slowdowns of the line. Regulation and collective action on climate change become an affront to your personal rights of progression, for example. Meanwhile, recovering from an extreme weather event, you might find yourself back in another line, waiting on emergency and rebuilding support that you need because of global heating. The line allegory was developed by Arlie Russell Hochschild, a sociologist who has researched emotional drivers within politics. She believes that working class people who are attached to the idea of the line and end up voting against their own best interests due to overwhelming resentment are exercising anger but also huge underlying grief. Hochschild also theorized the concept of emotional self-regulation as a form of service work known as emotional labor. Reading her work on emotional labor, I started thinking about how different linear and circular allegories might influence the processes of emotional self-regulation that emerge during crises. Images of lines and circles both generate and temper expectations of how wealth and resources are distributed. Waveforms. it's really hard to change an internalized image once it has a grip on your psyche. The thought experiment of imagining alternative imagery is an important one right now. In 2011, Occupy Wall Street attempted to use data visualization through typographic representation of the 1%, raising consciousness of unequal distribution of wealth and power in a way that could change our sense of how wealth is concentrated in the current system. In turn, this concentration undermines distribution via any imagined line. Astra Taylor creates an image of capitalism as an ongoing wave of destruction, inciting scarcity and precarity in an age of insecurity where capitalism is an insecurity-generating machine. In physics, waves distribute energy or force with varying degrees of impact and duration and can be represented as fluctuating lines. Taylor's wave forms of capitalist destruction might also be represented in this way and experienced as cycles of interference within the line. Similar ideas emerged in the 1940s. Joseph Schumpeter wrote that capitalism works through gales of creative destruction. It necessarily destroys wealth to create new wealth. Following this logic, defeatism within the climate crisis would allow the gales of creative destruction to play out within communities who don't have the resources to adapt. There's a bunch of scholarship being done around these ideas now, and I picked up on the links between these terms while I was listening to a podcast in the studio recently. NPR guest Jack Beattie noted that two generations of Americans have experienced these increased gales of creative destruction since the 1970s. Contemporary references to Schumpeter's meteorological metaphor focus us on the extreme weather created by capitalism, in both an ecological and socioeconomic sense. Betty was discussing the line and the impacts of perceived scarcity to understand the psyche of voters in upcoming elections, but I think it also illuminates the need to create conditions and visions for sharing resources differently in the face of climate change and the pandemic and in everyday struggles. Limits of empathy. In Aotearoa, people coming of age in the late 90s and first decade of the 2000s were born during a time of economic restructuring. Working class people had been thrown into line with these gales of creative destruction, further entrenching the impacts of colonial capitalism. By the mid-2000s, many young Pākehā artists were experiencing a confluence of anti-colonial and climate consciousness. Land occupations in the 1990s had been live broadcast, and events like the passing of the Foreshore and Seabed Act 2004 and the subsequent protest hikoi furthered awareness. Conversations about rising sea levels were happening at the same time as conversations about rights to that changing space between high water and low water. For elder millennials, our 20s were punctuated by big global and local events like 9/11 and the earthquakes in Ōtautahi. I wasn't in Ōtautahi during the earthquakes. At 12:51 p.m. on the 22nd of February 2011, I climbed under my desk in the offices of Te Kura Ponamu, the correspondence school in Thorndon, Te Whanganuia Tara. Over the following hours and days, Wellingtonians looked aghast to the south. Self-absorbed by our own tremors, we just hadn't thought or considered that the big one might happen elsewhere. The spectre of the earthquake had always been tangible in Te Whanganuia Tara because we had all felt the little quakes. They were measurable. The information reported to us by GNS and the media corresponded and aligned with what we each individually felt in our bodies as the earth moved. On February 22nd, I had a realization that something felt so intensely in one place could be felt very differently in another. Something I had understood in theory, but beyond occasional proximity to violence or accidents, I hadn't felt it physically before. The climate crisis had been unfolding for decades, a seemingly imperceptible, slow-slipping event. People in positions of power, under the thumb of petrochemical and capital interests, chose not to perceive the deadly registers of atmospheric imbalance, and their voters couldn't yet feel the impacts, physically or economically. Climate change was intangible and distant. In the early 2000s, climate reporting had an air of the unknown, a projection that didn't correspond to daily experiences, until it began to align. Between 2020 and 2023, people have experienced moments where our personal lives were altered by the biological and economic realities of a global pandemic, the circulation and reproduction of life-threatening viral matter, alongside the accelerating impacts of the climate crisis. In 2020, news of early viral spread hit the airwaves at the same time as our New Year horizons became dusty pink with drift from the Australian bushfires. Moments of personal and collective grief were met with empathy as a necessary part of the emotional processes of social cohesion that allow communities to survive. At the same time, these events exposed limits to that empathy. And as with climate change, the ongoing impacts of the pandemic have been felt unevenly, with access to vaccines limited to those countries who could afford them. Circular materialism. As an artist, I have been working with unstable materials and processes that involve reconfiguration and adaptation within particular situations and architectures. This often invites decomposition, but it attempts to resist a dead-end collapse. Since 2012, I've transitioned from using petrochemical latex paints and materials to bio-based ones. Initially, this came from a desire for that delaminated or peeled latex wall paint to have the capacity for rehydration, to become a hydrophilic, water-loving material. My work hasn't become about climate change or the pandemic, but these crises have focused my thinking about the limits of empathy, shaping my use of material empathy in processes of art making, decomposition and composition. There is a biopolymer aesthetics that has developed from this. Aesthetics in the sense of its root words of feeling and perceiving, beyond the retinal or the stylistic. These aesthetics are connected to plasticity, fluidity, and instability of polymers used in post-war practices where the material innovations of the war industry met consumer markets, including artists like Louise Bourgeois or Linda Benglis, who both used biopolymer and petrochemical polymers. Thinking through this history in an Aotearoa context, I focused on non-Indigenous material practices and asked artist Christine Hellyer how her awareness of land rights and ecological material relations developed over time, and at what point a specific consciousness of human-induced climate change began to influence her work. Awareness of colonial land confiscations and the ecological impacts of capitalism informed her material choices and subject matter while she was at art school during the 1960s, and she began experimenting with latex sourced from a Papakura glove manufacturer. Hellyer sourced latex from Scalarup Gumboot Factory in Ōtautahi, Christchurch too, to create artworks like Flotsam and Jetsam in 1970. Scalarup was a pragmatic choice rather than a conceptual one, but it does register the dominance of agricultural and colonial capitalism within our ecological and material cultures, disrupting romantic notions of unfettered New Zealand landscapes.
Industrial bio-based rubber production has involved extreme violence that isn't inherent to the material. It arises in the linear systems of colonial production. This complicates any sense of innocence around bio-based materials and needs to inform transitions from petrochemical material culture. Thinking about non-Indigenous hydrofeminisms and climate resilience here in Aotearoa, the iconic material ubiquity of waterproof and waterproud gummies, repurposed in the form of artworks, offers an egalitarian way to move through floodplains.